Welcome to The Intentional Investor with Matt Ziegler, where he and his guests explore the intersection of investing and life, portfolio and purpose. Nothing in this podcast is investment advice. Nothing in this podcast is advising you to buy or sell any security or to do anything with your money. Seriously, you should only act on investment advice from someone you know and who knows your unique situation. We are not that person. Matt Ziegler is a managing director at SunPoint Investments, and the opinions expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect the opinions of SunPoint Investments or of Second Foundation Partners. Securities discussed in the podcast may be holdings of SunPoint Investments.
Hello and welcome to The Intentional Investor on the Epsilon Theory YouTube channel. I'm your host, Matt Ziegler, and I'm joined today by Mr. Social Leverage, Mr. StockTwits CEO, Mr. Captain of Team Gelato, who I understand to be a cigarette-endorsed Italian bike riding team. Mr. Friends, not as in the 90s sitcom, but you've panicked with friends. You've turned it into Trends with Friends. More recently, I see you've added Trends with No Friends, which I love, by the way.
Yeah, people love it. Yeah.
And we'll make sense of all this, but Mr. Howard Lindzen, welcome to The Intentional Investor.
Good to see you. Good to see you. It was fun to meet you. I mean, we randomly met. That's kind of how life... I'm very much a, as I get older, I do less of it. I become more grumpy Larry David, but I'm very much a stumbling, bumbling investor.
And, you know. Well, what I love about this is we're going to talk about where portfolio meets purpose. That's the whole point of this show here with our doing this with our mutual friend, Ben Hunt in the background, who loved this idea. But I know from getting to know you and talking to you, how much you think about this stuff beyond just the money aspect of it. So let's have some fun. We're going to spend an hour together. I want to start here. I want to go all the way back to the 80s. I want to go back to sneaking into Yuck Yucks.
Yeah.
Is this something you advocate, you know, teenagers sneaking in underage to comedy clubs in Canada?
Well, I think now teenage kids are sneaking into Columbia from other universities to protest. Like, it's a little different. We were not that serious. We had Mothers Against Drunk Drivers in the 70s or 60s. I was born in 65. So in my primal years, so just now recently, a few podcasts, is we just went through a syrup environment where the world was supposed to be an engineer.
Okay.
And I used to have the saying, punch a banker, hug an engineer. And now it's more like punch an engineer, hug a businessman. We need more business people. But, you know, when I started comedy, there was no internet. There was Second City. Canada was like a very big comedy town when I was coming of age. Second City, John Candy, Eugene Levy, Mike Myers, Jim Carrey. And Toronto was what Stanford was for engineers. It was a hotbed for whatever reason in the water of comedy. And there was this club called Yuck. There was Cafe on the Park. There was, you go see comedy anywhere in Toronto, right? But there was a chain called Yuck Yucks and open mic night. And I used to go, and I was probably 15. And you're not funny when you're 15. Well, you're funny if you're Jim Carrey. That's how obvious it was. But you're not
funny. You're funny to your friends, though. Like, that's the whole goal.
But your friends aren't in the audience. They're not.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
They're not paying to get in.
Yeah, making fun of my Jewish mother, that doesn't go well in a Pakistani crowd in Toronto. So you had no context. So I definitely wasn't good at it, but I definitely loved comedy. So you grew up watching Johnny Carson, and you're smoking cigarettes, and you had friends on, just talking about this ex-wife. And I was just a kid who thought that was the greatest. Even though I didn't know anything, I just thought Johnny Carson was the greatest. What a job. Like, I don't know. I was lucky, rich, had a TV as a kid, and my parents didn't check on me, and I watched Johnny Carson, and Steve Martin was coming of age, and he had his comedy albums, and Woody Allen's comedy albums. They were fantastic, and at least I had good taste. Like, I didn't, you know, I was never a Bill Cosby fan, not that you shouldn't have been, but it was Woody Allen, who's weird. It was Steve Martin, and it was all these, it was Second City Television that inspired me. And I saw Mike Myers when he was just beginning and Jim Carrey when they were just beginning. And you knew.
Yeah, which is wild.
You just knew.
Yeah, well, fire.
What I'm saying is you hear their name later and go, I remember that guy. And you just knew when he was 15, they were killing it. Jim Carrey was killing it.
Yeah, nobody did physical comedy like that. It's no surprise.
and voices. Mike Myers was just character driven, very young age. Just high drama, high drama for a 15-year-old on stage. Huge stage presence, and probably one of the most successful people of all time is
easily
comedy. Yeah, so lucky for me, that was what a great coming of age, you know.
So you take this with you. You come to the States from Canada for college, right? That's how you end up in Arizona.
Yeah, and my parents. Born on third base, so we had a home in Paradise Valley.
Okay.
I was into golf. I love golf, and luckily my parents liked Arizona, and it was a golf place, and I saw ASU. I went to a football game when I was like 11. I'm like, I'm going to school in Arizona State. And it wasn't like the other Canadian kids that were like staying at home, you know? So that was my goal, is to move to the States when I was 11.
So you go to Arizona, you finish school, do an MBA, I think. And then was stockbroker the first job out of college? Do I have this right?
Yeah, I was Canadian. So it was 90s recession, Gulf War. So it was like, how am I going to stay in the United States, right? Like you open the newspaper, graduate, no one was hiring, it was a recession. And so you went to classifieds, and it was just every job was for stockbroker. Everything was a cold calling job back in 90. So I just picked a cold calling job where you got to wear a suit. So it looked like an MBA could do it, you know? And that was my first job, and they sponsored me to some form of visa. And it was a Dallas firm called Epler, Guerin and Turner, which I think eventually became Dean Rauscher, which eventually became RBC. It was like 100 things on the way, you know, roll-ups. But yeah, it's cold calling. 1990.
Amazing. So you're smiling, dialing, and cold calling. And then if I have the story right, you end up cold calling somebody who ends up pitching you? Somebody flips the tables on you?
Yeah, back then you got the newspaper and you local Arizona business. And you would just look for rich people, I guess. Like, I don't know, there's no instructions. Yeah, I don't know what I was doing. And I was just killing time. And maybe I was making 20-something grand a year, 30 grand a year, plus commissions. And this guy was, you know, holding this ball called The Grip. There's a picture of him, entrepreneur, local entrepreneur. And I cold called him, went down to see him. And next thing you know, he was asking me for money. And I was smart enough to scrounge up a little bit of money to give to him. And off we went. I quit my brokerage job after a couple of years, and his company was blowing up, and we built this product called Pro Innovative Concepts, which was this incredibly fast growing, high margin products, promotional products company, in the mid 90s. It was like a pet rock in the QVC Hall of Fame was our product, and we would go on QVC and the product would just sell and sell and sell and sell millions of dollars worth. And it was pretty cool pre-internet growth story.
And this is like, this company never went public. This was just a private thing.
No, I think the highest we got was like 30, 40 million in sales, which was huge. We didn't know.
Oh, yeah.
We were literally like clueless, clueless operators. We were doing every mistake, but we had such high margin, right? Like we had we were making the balls, the squeeze balls ourselves, and we were selling them with corporate logos on them. So our return, it wasn't like a hard business, like the business was just lucked into it. So we were getting paid before we shipped our product, and there were no returns because you put a corporate logo on it. So we had this incredible business that like had high margins, profitable before we started making the product, and very little receivables. So that leads to a lot of bad business habits when you're printing money, which we did. We made a lot of mistakes.
Sure. But high margins cushion mistakes. That's like one of the great things, right? If you have something to help you hide the mistake or make you not learn the lesson.
Yes.
How's that one? What happens?
It's a great question. It wasn't my company, right? It was a tiny, tiny. Yeah, yeah. So it was just aggravation. It was just like, wasn't my company. I felt we were just, I was the MBA guy that was like, got to do it this way. Like, look at this case study right here about Duraflame.
Yeah.
And he was like, what the I'm a fireman. Like,
why are you telling me about dirt flight right now?
Yeah. So, he didn't want to be a business. He was, it was like an S corp. He was just buying car. It was just a fun, he was treating it as a personal bank account. He's a fucking great entrepreneur, great guy. It wasn't my business. And I was like, I'm going to start a hedge fund. Because before the internet, being an entrepreneur meant opening up a clothing store and or a restaurant or
brick and mortar.
Before the cloud, it was brick and mortar. So, you know, I was like, I don't want to do brick and mortar. I'll just start a hedge fund and ask people for money, even though I had no experience. So that was a horrific mistake because I hated every minute of it, but it was an entrepreneur, you know, that's what I was doing. I was managing our money that we were making selling squeeze balls. And luckily it was a bull market. So the 90s were very good. And I eked out a living through the mid 2000 to about 2005. And then I was just so sick of doing that. And luckily the internet came along.
Well, the internet came along before.
Not a good internet. A DOS internet came along.
But a crappy internet. Okay. Yeah. So a crappy internet comes before you survive the internet bubble on squeeze balls and hedge funds.
Yes.
Well, running one.
I don't say I would survive. I was miserably conservative. I just didn't understand the markets well enough yet. You know, it was the first real bear market that I was like, I was scared. Like, you know, I just didn't, wasn't used to seeing things go down every day. And, you know, the NASDAQ went through an 88% decline, right? So it's just like, no matter what you did, you were wrong for a while. And so that really shapes, you know, 9/11. It really just shapes your risk profile. Whatever wasn't shaped as a child was really got shaped by my first bear market, which was, you know, 2000 to 2005. I was like, fuck, I don't know what I'm doing. This is like, I really didn't know what I was doing. And I was just, people trusted me, but I honestly was learning on other people's money. So it wasn't like a joyous career. It was like, how stupid am I going to look today? And, you know, so in the end, that's good training because I just learned that stocks can be fire, not things that go to the moon. And, but it did shape my risk profile tremendously.
Do you feel like that whole learning to be miserably conservative through that phase of being, because I guess being accountable, not just for your own money, but being accountable to other people's money, especially during the bear market, that sucks. Done it.
Yeah, I probably wish I think I could be a YOLOer if I didn't have that era to have gone through.
Okay.
I can appreciate the YOLOers. I think they're dumb. I don't think they're.
But you know where they came from or come from.
I know where they came from. Like, I understand why it's happening and the game's rigged towards making everybody a YOLOer. So I understand it completely. I don't envy them. I think it's not a way to riches. But, so I got punished. Like, I think it's like the sooner you get punished, the better. You know, parents that helicopter and don't punish their kids are not helping their kids, right? You got to feel the fire.
It's that Jesse Livermore thing. It's the cost of tuition and that comes, you have to lose something to learn something.
Yeah. So I think I've been very lucky. Post internet, there's just been very fewer lessons. Everybody's got their doppelganger in every country. You on 24/7. You can build a business for nothing. You have instant communication. There's negatives with that, of course, but that didn't exist. The scale of what, you know, before that it was all about Excel. Now you don't need Excel. It's just you can grow. So I think we went from an Excel world, which was a rather boring fixed world, to this open cloud world where no one knows anything. Now this world where you have to be a business person. Excel does matter. The cloud does matter. AI does matter. But you know what matters the most? Being business person, like, you know, doing it all. Like,
outside of all this stuff, in this period, like when you get married, when did you start a family? Was that early 2000s?
Got married in 96, I believe. It's coming up at 29th anniversary.
Get a good present here. Yeah.
So got married in 96. I was 30, 31. And then we had kids pretty quickly. By the time I was 33, we had two. And that was it, you know. So my daughter was born in 98, my son in 2000.
Right? So this, so like,
combined with the stress of the kids, we had the crash and we had just,
yeah, that's misery. A lot.
Yeah, it was a lot.
That's a lot.
9/11, all those things combined. So that definitely changed my risk profile. Plus, my wife's a bankruptcy attorney, so she thinks everything goes to zero.
Oh, okay. That's good. Know.
Yeah.
Well, everything
she's never seen a business she liked.
Never seen a business she liked.
Yeah. They all end up in bankruptcy.
You guys met in Arizona. It is true.
Yeah. Yeah. Blind date.
Blind date.
The original Tinder, where a family member introduces you.
Okay. Through a family member, though, that was the trusted app of choice for 1990.
Yeah. I mean, back then it was just, you go out, I guess. Once you start working, it's very hard to meet somebody. So yeah, you took blind dates. I think that's still a thing.
It's still a thing. So does she think you're crazy? Like, while you're running money for other people and you're dealing with the kids, like, what gets you out of the hedge fund space?
YouTube. So again, I guess it's still a creative, even though I wasn't doing creative stuff at a hedge fund to try to survive, I think I still had that creative soul. And YouTube came out, and it was probably the first internet product that like made sense to me, right? I got lucky. There was an Apple store across from my office in Phoenix, stumbled in there in probably 2002, bought my first iPod. The white headband. And I was just like, that's the future.
Yeah.
Right. Like, you know, and so I got lucky. I was just stumbled in, and everybody thought Apple stores was a bad idea. Gateway had failed, like Dell. Like, there was just no way Apple's going to. But I was just in that store and I saw the traffic, and I was the user of the product, and it was my first big hit. Like, I was like, I'm Apple. And, you know, in the hedge fund brokerage business, there's no Apple. You were using Internet Explorer and you were using, like, you know, market data from like some, you had to use an IBM machine, you know, you had to use a Dell machine or whatever, a compact computer. There was no Apple computers. There was no internet. And then, you know, you were using Netscape or Internet Explorer. And I think it just became such an Apple fanboy. I was like, I got to move my business, like everything to the internet. And it just couldn't. It was just so tough to run like a research and investing business off Apple products and just the internet. And so I was just unhappy and dilly-dallying, and YouTube came out. And while everybody thought that was silly, I was like, man, this is the future. And I just started, you know, a company. Like, basically my idea was to put CNBC on YouTube and create a 24-hour, you know, business channel on the internet. And very much like Second City Television with Johnny, it was these guys creating a cable. It was just a spoof of a cable television show. That's what I grew up with. So I said, wouldn't it be funny if I just did a 24-hour YouTube channel of Second City meets CNBC? And I pitched Fred Wilson, who is like one of the most famous investors. He was just a regular guy to me on the internet. He loved the idea, and he invested. And off we were running, raised about $600,000 to start Wall Strip. And 7 months later, we sold it to CBS for, you know, close to $10 million. So pretty good IRR. We had no business. We were just making this one show a day. So we set out to build a 24-hour CNBC, and we built a 3-minute daily web video show that sold for $10 million. I go, I'm in, you know. So I was done with finance for good, working for CBS.
You were going to be famous.
I was internet celebrity for a moment.
Absolutely.
And I never looked back. I mean, I was done with the world of investing. Okay. And quickly came back to the world of investing because Fred Wilson and a lot of the people I had made money with started showing me deals. And, you know, all of a sudden I was some expert, I guess. So people were showing me things, and I was just smart enough to say, yep, I'm in for 10K or 25K. So I was just writing checks at the right place at the right time as Web 2 exploded. And you had to be pretty bad not to make money. So let's just say I did pretty well.
Well, go back to this for a second because I'm fascinated by this. You meet Fred Wilson. How do you meet Fred Wilson? Was it like in the comments on his blog?
Yeah.
AVC?
I was searching for term sheet. I was Googled. I didn't know how to set up a term sheet because I was looking at a golf company in Phoenix called Golf Now. But again, before I even had the idea for,
Nobody
for Wall Street.
Just keep repeating with you. We have comedy clubs in YouTube and Second City TV. We have golf.
So,
you have like six through lines.
I was searching for, this guy had stumbled into my office pitching me his son's golf company. And I was like, it's an unbelievable idea. Tee times, you know, it was kind of open table for golf. I didn't know how to write a term sheet. So I searched term sheet on Google and all these venture capitalist blogs showed up. And so I stumbled into Fred Wilson's blog and I searched term sheet and he was just, here's how you do a seed stage term sheet. And I was like, holy fuck, that was easy. Copy paste. And then discovered his blog and sent him a thank you note in the comments. And we just became this cast of characters on this very famous venture capitalist blog who was kind of one of the best investors and media guys, just a regular guy. But he had this, he used the blog as a way to, it was like the original Twitter, except there was just one channel, Fred.
You
go onto Fred's site and there'd be the bouncer and it was it was just all these cast of characters that were like running Fred's community as if we were like a mini Twitter. Like if there was a guy making fun of somebody, we'd kick him off or we'd tell Fred.
Sure.
Like it was just the center of the internet for that type of stuff. And so there was this great keiretsu at the beginning of Web 2, right? Everything was so new. Like the idea that you could just communicate. So everybody was, of course, there was mean keyboard warriors back then too, but just Fred, the aura of Fred just kept everybody positive. And we were all there just like, this is like, oh my God, we're friends with Fred. We're seeing all these great deals. Just keep your mouth shut and don't cause a problem. And so Fred was sharing all this knowledge and this whole group of bloggers, David Cowan, Brad Feld, just all of us were just now paying it forward and writing blogs and linking to each other. And that was the internet links. And, that was how the internet really Web 2 started, was the cloud and links. And it was just a bunch of people just sharing ideas.
And this whole like playing it forward thing. So the brokerage thing, you do the stockbroker thing, it turns into the grip thing and the squeeze ball things. It turns into the hedge fund thing. It turns into meeting Fred Wilson, Googling term sheet, Wall Street sold to CBS. Now you have money and now you're getting to write checks. You're starting to make these first private investments.
Yeah. And I ran out of money. 25K, it doesn't seem like a lot until you write like six of them. And then you're like,
it stacks up.
Over allocated to, and they're illiquid. And three of them seem like really bad ideas. You know what I mean? Like, the hit rate's not as good as people think.
Right.
And so you realize you can't play in that world. I didn't have that much money. So I had, you know, Twitter came along and I was so fascinated by it. It was pre iPhone. So it was a BlackBerry. We were all using BlackBerries, including Fred Wilson. And I said, Fred, when Fred invested in Twitter and he showed me the deal, then it was a $3 million raise on 17. And you gotta understand at the time, Twitter was popular already. It was probably 100,000 people using it and all BlackBerry and no one was ridiculous, just venture capitalists and no neck like me. And we all thought it was dumb. Like, so 90% of the conversation is this is stupid. So that's what Twitter was at the beginning. Kind of pretty much the same thing as today. 90% of the people
circle.
Going, Twitter's pretty stupid.
Right.
But in between, there's $44 billion of value created and destroyed. But he pitched it to me and I was like, I can't fit. I've already written six checks.
Yeah.
Three of them are going to zero. And this one seems so overpriced. I remember saying to him, I was like lecturing Fred. I was like, dude, like, how are you going to make money? This is $20 million valuation. Like, what are you, the idiot? And I was like yelling at him. And he goes, okay, you don't have to do it. And I think that 25K check would be worth about $8 million.
Yeah, it did okay.
Yeah,
it's an okay IRR.
As luck would have it, even though I didn't make that check, I started StockTwits. And I was super bullish on Twitter as an ecosystem and made a lot of Bitly, TweetDeck, just made a ton of investments around the ecosystem. And I've done well despite missing like the granddaddy, which was Twitter. Even though I was a user, I made the cardinal error of projecting my, you know, I was, Fred understood that the Excel spreadsheet was coming to an end. So I came from this Excel world.
Right.
And Twitter was the beginning, and YouTube were the beginning of a non-Excel world where there was no model. You had to network was the model. And Fred had a brain that
could see these things.
I guess that's why he's the best.
Yeah, exactly.
To live in a non-Excel world when no one understood what a non-Excel world was, right? Like, it's fucking, that's why he's a billionaire.
So at the same time,
I'm a thousandaire. I'm a thousandaire because I still think Excel is useful.
Microsoft thanks you for your service. The idea though, because a lot of good comes out of this. So StockTwit's built on the API of Twitter. Correct. And this is, what year is this? When did StockTwit start?
2007.
So in 2007.
It started as a Tumblr blog and we were connected to the API. And I was always yelling at Fred. I'd sent him this BlackBerry message to buy RIM. $RIMM, because you couldn't search. Twitter was already a mess with hashtags. And so I came up with the hashtag, and just by luck, it just made sense, $ticker. And Fred sent me back an immediate BlackBerry BBM saying, this is very genius. And, you know, within a week, I was pitching Jack and Ev at Twitter HQ that they should have twitter.finance.com and they would rule the world and take over Yahoo and Bloomberg. They didn't see what I saw. I was like, eventually the president's going to tweet. like that's what I was saying in 07. I didn't know he'd be orange and loud and, you know, have 10 thumbs, but I was right. There's a big difference between being right though and making money. And I went in to pitch Jack and Ev and I was like, why don't you slow down the stream? Like, you know, if Kim Kardashian farts in a crowded room, do people really need to hear about that? And what is real time? Like 5 minutes delay matter versus if you get Osama bin Laden, that's going to drive the futures, right? Like if a plane lands on the Hudson, like that airline stock or, you know, is going to change, right? So Twitter just didn't think about, they're just engineers. They're San Francisco engineers. They weren't Wall Street guys. If they had been Wall Street guys, it would have been a much different ending to Twitter, much more profitable ending. And for bad or for good, they saw it as like kumbaya, you know, world peace, Arab Spring, plane lands on the Hudson, they're saving lives. And I was like, you guys don't get it. Like, just delay the stream 30 seconds and you'll be billionaires.
Right. And that's all you have to do.
Yeah. They slow can still it down, do that today. Now Elon's doing that for himself. So, you know, I'm sure he's got a hedge fund somewhere trading against the stream. That's just me. That's the way I believe the world works. You know, it's going to monetize it somehow.
Somehow, some way, even if it has to offset some Cybertruck incidents at the moment. Yeah.
Yeah.
You got to tell this story too, just because when I was going back through stuff, you did have a fun exchange, I think, at one point with Jack Dorsey on Twitter, where I believe your daughter stepped in to defend you.
Yeah, a few.
You know the one I'm talking about?
Always, yeah. So okay. I think I don't know the guys very well, but it was always confrontational with at least Jack, you know? And even they had so much management over the time, like the good guys at Twitter were, you know, gone by then. Josh Ellman, who's now at Apple, and people that really loved Twitter for the community side of it. Twitter always felt like fake community, the way they called things Flock and Bluebird, and just always felt like fake, right? This goes to me talking about today's world. You got to be a business person. You can't get away with being Jack anymore or these people, like, you know, so with Jack, it was always just like, what the hell? Like you can't run one company while you're running two. So it's just what people do on FinTwit. What is FinTwit? Armchair quarterbacking. Like, again, like may not like us, but I consider myself the best corp dev person in the world. I'm doing it for free all day on Twitter.
Correct. Because,
I mean, it's what you do. I don't know. Second guessing. I'm like, I could run a curriculum in second guessing 101. So for years, we've been second guessing Jack Dorsey. And I think at one point he's just fed up with me and he came at me as he shouldn't have done. This is why I don't think he knows how to use his product. Meaning, don't mess with Howard because my daughter was on Twitter too. And so he sent back a picture of a mosquito or something, like I'm a pest or like just an asshole. And eloquent Jack, one character. Oh, I got you. And then he said something like, it seems like you need a hug. This is coming from a guy who, like, I don't know what his sexuality is, but he hasn't been. These guys all project. He hasn't been. This is the aggravating part. They're not normal. And I'm sure he's a good guy, but, like, you don't pick a fight like this. Like, he's a public figure, so that's what you do on Twitter. So maybe I went too far. I get that. So he came back with a mosquito. And I went, okay, that's as good as Jack can do. My daughter, who happens to be on the internet, comes in over the top, and she says, Jack, my dad got a lot of hugs. And Jack quickly fled the scene of the accident. And I think that's
just... You don't respond back.
Yeah, you can't. Your fight with my daughter is coming to mind. Right. So I just think that was the era of Jack, right? Like, it was... They gave this guy power over a product that's just an immensely incredible product that's always somehow just been an inch off. And it's a shame. We went from, I think, Jack being bullied by the left, as the left can do, as we're seeing, to Elon, who just, if you bully him from whatever angle, he's going to take the opposite side. So what you ended up with an angry right. Now you just have angry Twitter, because the guy running it really just, if you bully him, it doesn't matter what side you're on, you're going to get bullied back. And I don't think I think that kills Twitter. I mean, Twitter as we know it is a dead product. And I say that because I know a lot of employees that don't use it from the early days. I only use a desktop version. So I don't feel like I'm going to miss anything if I don't use Twitter. Whereas, for about 10 years, Twitter was, if you weren't on Twitter, you were not in the flow. And now I would say, if you're using Twitter from your mobile, you're wasting your time. And I say that confidently as someone who doesn't use Twitter mobile. And I say that confidently about, being friends with really smart people, that it takes about 3 to 5 days to kill pretty much any habit, from maybe not heroin, but even with good 3 to 5 days, whether it's sugar or whether it's, fit, you can get yourself kind of off most habits in 3 to 5 days. And Twitter is quite simply another one of those habits that people can get over if they want to put their mind to it. You're not missing anything. And I think there was about a 10-year period where if you weren't on Twitter and really putting in the work, you were completely missing it. And I feel like that was an edge that no longer is an edge. And part of the edge is not knowing that it's not an edge anymore. It's not a real-time network anymore, period, end of story, full stop.
Go back there for a second. Then I want to talk about what networks have replaced that, because I think that's really interesting for this. But say at least, go back to Robinhood. Robinhood happens because you break off of, you use the API, you start StockTwits. Mm-hmm. Robinhood only happens as an opportunity because you started StockTwits, arguably.
Correct.
That's fair to say?
Correct. Yeah.
Tell the story about how that happens and what they saw as the opportunity, which was kind of everybody else's customer acquisition cost. And this starts a turning in the whole market.
Yeah, it happened much later than I would have suspected. So I had the idea for Robinhood way back with Fred. I was pitching this with StockTwits. I just didn't want to build a broker dealer. So I'm not a software guy. I'm not a SEC guy. So the original idea was like 2008. I went to Jack and Evan. I'm like, guys, just buy a brokerage. You have, if Mark Andreessen says he likes Apple, shouldn't you be able to click on the Apple ticker and buy the stock? And they were like, kumbaya, someone else will build it. I don't know what they were saying, but they sure as hell didn't care. And so it took up much longer for people to have the same epiphany that I had. So again, if I trusted myself, which I did, and I had all this data in my head, no one in America was building this, right? The Apple Store comes out in 2009. And no one's building a brokerage. What people were doing was building a competitor to to Vanguard. So the way venture capitalists work, and I learned this, you know, through this Robinhood exercise, because is that VCs just didn't believe that there should be another E-Trade, for better or for worse. That was their decision. Mm-hmm. And their angle of attack was assets under management. To them, venture capitalists were like, let's put money to work and let's disrupt Vanguard. And my whole understanding of Vanguard and Betterment and Wealthfront and all these companies that were being funded, it's like, this isn't 10 times better than Vanguard. In fact, like,
yeah,
it's a trap, because you go with Wealthfront. If you're not unhappy, it's easy to switch. Like, there's like the switching cost is zero, which is really dangerous. If you're going to go pay for a user and then they're unhappy and they leave in a second. And it wasn't 10 times better than Vanguard. So I just had that one instinct that I was waiting for there to be because of stock twits and Twitter, I knew that if you sent a link, I just thought that was going to lead to a tremendous explosion of trading. And no one else really believed that. So when Robinhood pitched me, this was already after I had backed eToro. So the first company to pitch me this was a company in Israel. I had flown over to Israel to speak at a conference. And the first company to pitch was a company called eToro Yoni Asia. And I saw it was really crude. Trading platform on mobile phone called eToro. And it was like, I was like, this is genius. And I was lucky to invest in that as a seed investor back in 2010. And, you know, still holding today, it's probably a $4 or $5 billion company.
Yeah.
And quietly built a huge business overseas. And so Robinhood didn't even pitch me until late 2013. So eToro had been around 5-6 years already, but not making a dent in the United States. And so Vlad and Baiju pitched me. They had already tried to copy StockTwits. They'd come the right background. They were Stanford guys. They were quant guys. And they were working on speed trading. I forget what it's called. And that's how little I know about the infrastructure stuff. But they knew infrastructure from trying to create quant products. But they weren't having success on the consumer side. But they had this one last idea, which was to build, a very mobile, friendly kind of Snapchat of trading. And as luck would have it, they called me and they were out of money, and I flew up to Silicon Valley and they pitched me, and I saw the app and I'm like, if you build that, that's a home run. So we put in $100,000, which is kind of the check size we had at the time. And I just called my network and I said, this is the one. And, it's really one of those rare things that I was just right.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like it was just right place, right time. I had the domain experience. I had stock twits. I knew the Twitter, what it was doing wrong. If they built it, and believe me, they made a lot of mistakes along the way, and people know, and ZERP has led to a lot of business mistakes, a lot of like, oh, let's go to China in year two. I mean, that's not smart. You know what I mean? Like, it's the history will get rewritten and glossed over, but man, some of the money waste, some of the misallocation of capital, despite the success of some of these companies, is just staggering. And, you know, it hurts. You know, it done very well off these investments, but it hurts how unstructured and how poorly thought through and how much capital was wasted to get to what, five apps that matter? Uber, maybe Robinhood, Coinbase, Airbnb, Google Maps, Spotify. Spotify's only 50 billion. So I'm saying not that much came from
all that money invested.
Yeah, which goes to why I said it's an era of business people coming up next. Like, that was just a misdirection. And you think about what NVIDIA says, I'm not a tech person, but if half of what he said is true and the GPU is the new computer, right? You don't need to engineer. Wouldn't that be nice? Because what's the worst part about, what did Steve Jobs hate? Engineers. What's the worst part about building a startup? Fucking engineering costs. You got to build for Android. You got to build for iOS. You don't even know what's under the hood. So I think NVIDIA is probably going to be the biggest company in the world if they're correct, because they solves the biggest cost problem of this new generation, which is overpriced engineers who move code around and are almost as evil as the oil barons at this point, right? Moving a code around to get you to spend 1 second longer on a website. Probably the least productivity for the dollar invested of all time.
Right. And not that Adderall.
It's a new form of tobacco. It's a new form of tobacco. Social is just a new form of tobacco.
So inside of this, go back to this business, the business person idea. So we're moving, we're past the spreadsheet. I don't want to say we're past the cloud yet. We're into this new era of this period. And like, why, what's the business person? What's this angle? What's this perspective you have?
Well, you have to use Excel. You know, so by Excel, meaning you can do acquisitions. You still need Excel to measure things. You still need Excel to have a business model that says, here's what my margins are. You can't just raise capital and worry about margins later. You have to know what the margins are today. Like, right. Well, how many units, widgets would you have to sell? Like the old movie, Old School, Back to School. It's back to school days.
You should go watch that movie. We need more Rodney Dangerfield.
Yes, we need more people reading Shoe Dog. In his first 10 years, he got to 10 million in sales. And you shouldn't have to live the life of Shoe Dog because that was a horrible life. He had to get on planes and be away from his family. But you have to pull away the good things that a Shoe Dog, which is these great businesses take time. When I hear founders, I think Mark Pincus said it, and it was very, you know, in hindsight, I don't think he's just saying it, but, oh, I'm going to build a 100-year company. You don't, no one, if you say that, I immediately distrust you. Like, the point is you should build a business that works. And if it becomes a 100-year company, you'll know in 40 years. So I think we have to get back to the idea of what's the business, right? Like in an era of like, I've seen Uber, but let's be honest, there's tons of mistakes, man. I've seen Airbnb, let's be honest, is it that great? I've seen, you know what I mean? Like I've seen everything. So now that I've seen everything and I've seen Zerp, and I've seen bad behavior and I've seen good behavior and I've seen, you know, stupidity and I've seen bubbles. Okay. What is your idea? And why are you doing this? And like, do you want to do this for 10 years? Like, we got to get back to asking these questions. It's like, why are you doing this? Like, gee, like, this is a grind. Like, maybe go be a second and third command or a fourth command or go be travel and be, you know, go be a journalist. So I think we have to ask better questions. You know, the allocators of capital have gone away with being bad allocators or misallocators of capital because capital's been a commodity. It's been 0% interest rate. It's like, whew, they'll just print more. But in an era where they may not print it and now capital's constrained, how do you build businesses in a capital-constrained world? Well, as luck would have it, we've never been loose with capital because of who I am and how my risk profile was formulated. I've seen bankruptcy and I've seen 88% drawdowns in an index. So I just can't get that out of my head.
This is the benefits of being a miserable conservative or miserably conservative. Yeah. You called it.
It's the benefits of just seeing the towers go down 9/11 and not sleeping and really seeing trauma, really feeling it. And October 6th was one of those moments, October 7th for a Jewish person. It's like traumatic. Yeah, see what's going on in Colombia. I'm very upset. So I just think it's time for people to be more serious about not being an entrepreneur, right? And some of the people that we trusted have completely blown their cover, you know, in a Bill Cosby way. Paul Graham at Y Combinator. We were kissing that ring, not necessarily just me. He was writing these essays and he seemed like just like Bill Cosby was writing jokes. Peel back the curtain. You see a monster of a human being in Paul Graham, just a monster that people idolize because he's allocating capital to overpriced startups from Stanford. His stance on how he thinks about the UN and Israel, he doesn't give a shit. So again, like you peel back, it's kind of like Wizard of Oz. The wizard has been exposed, you know? And they were an era of loose capital, the cloud, Apple, the internet. Let's see what you do in the next go around. Let's see what you go through a real bear market. And, you know, so again, I just be careful who you trust, be careful who you take capital from, be careful who you listen to on the internet. Those are things we take very seriously, social leverage, and be careful of me. I mean, I'm out there projecting, telling people my story, you don't have to like me. You go to YC. Just know that I won't fund you. By the way, we stopped funding people from Harvard years ago. We had bad actors years ago. This stuff has been going on for decades with Harvard and, you know, Berkeley. Just because you're smart doesn't mean you can run a company. And so we're starting to see these things speed up because, listen, I hire from Arizona State. I went to Arizona State. Why? I don't know why I was so biased against hiring from Arizona State. There's great kids. I went there. It was a bit of a knucklehead.
Yeah.
So I think that ribbon, that's been ripped off the cover, right? So I think there's just, what a great time to be a business person and to get good mentorship and to pick good mentors and to build good habits, especially in an era where, as I just told you, you can break any bad habit in 3 to 5 days. So what a great time to build good habits. You don't need Twitter. You don't need all this nonsense. You just need, and so I think email is the next big thing. I think smaller networks are the next big thing. Obviously, Telegram's very popular. I don't use it, but it's very popular. I love WhatsApp. You know,
WhatsApp's awesome.
I have days where I don't use it, but there are days where I need it.
Sure.
So I'm very much, the phone has become face down most of the time. I work from my desktop. It's purposeful work. I don't think it's for everybody, but if I have my desktops, I have very nice desktops and I have them in different places. And that's my workspace. You know, that's where I'm doing my serious work. If I have my phone, it's for using the phone, right? The smaller, the better. FaceTime works great. Zoom works great. But generally I like to do my Zooms like this.
Yeah.
My phone is for phoning people and for emergency texts. And for goofing off, right?
But important stuff.
Really, yeah, I think the desktop is for the important stuff. So I just think this is going to be an era of like incredible businesses being built. So I'm pretty bullish, pretty bullish.
Yeah, I think you have to be because that's
not bullish on tech. I'm just bullish on like good business practices.
Well, it's a different skill set. I feel like that's part of the reason to be bullish because the skill set just shifted again.
Yeah. The skill set switched to marketing too.
Right.
And show me a good marketer. Like if you know how to do Facebook, that's just one little aspect that's been arbed away, right? Show me how to do billboards. Show me how to do a TV ad, cause you've got an arbitrage there. Show me like real marketing. Show me how to write copy. Show me to get customers without spending. You know, customer acquisition was free for about 8 years and so was money. Of course you were rich. I mean, you're supposed to get rich. Customer acquisition was free and money was free. I just happened to be lucky. Now, there's some people that are now packaging themselves as these geniuses. And I didn't see that coming. I really didn't see people being foolish enough to believe in these false prophets of the Web 2.
Same. And I think part of what's so interesting about customer acquisition being free, and even in the Robin Hood story, like part of what made Robin Hood great was
stock twits. They don't appreciate it, but stock twits. I got them their first 100,000 users because I was giving away accounts before they were even live on stock twits. So you had to follow me to get access. Again, I did that. I made money off that. Meaning I did my people that follow me got a service. I got onto Robinhood early. I made money because I was a Robinhood shareholder. Like that's where you make the money. But am I happy about how I didn't predict how things would end.
Sure.
You know, this was that era that everybody was just free.
And it's so interesting though, how it's the, like in that case, the acquisition is free because you're telling me on StockTwits to do this, hey, check this thing out. That's all like free advertising, that word of mouth
free.
Virality.
It was negative, like Uber.
Right.
You told 10 people. Not only was it free, you told 10 people. Holy shit. Go try that same strategy today. People won't click on the link.
Exactly. Because nobody will, the trust factor, we've raised this threshold for how we trust this stuff.
When's the last time you downloaded an app that actually changed your life? Like never.
Right. In fact, the best I could get is re-downloading an app. You're like, oh crap, I'm at the airport. I have to re-download.
You're going to have to hear it 20 times from different sources before you'll try something now. Right. And that's the penalty for being so easy for too long. And so it's a whole different type of mindset that's going to prosper. A whole new set of skills is going to prosper. I wish I was 40, but I happen to be 60-ish. So, you know, my punishment is time is behind me. I'm now in the later stages of my career. So we're trying to pay it forward and tell people this stuff. No one's really listening. Everybody still wants to get rich quick. I don't blame them. I would too.
Everybody wants to get rich quick, but is that, I mean, what would you say to that? If I'm a 20-year-old coming to you and
saying—
I don't
know how it happens. I think it did happen during this era.
It definitely did.
Yeah.
I've met some of them. I've worked with some of them.
And I think, God bless them. I mean, you can't undo it, you know? So I'm just like, but you have to, they're not serious people, a lot of these people.
Yeah. Right?
Because they can't possibly be serious, because how could they possibly appreciate being an overnight success? That's like, that's not their fault.
But is this part of the YOLOing thing? Fault. Like, if you live,
no,
is it different? No, how do you separate that?
Everything's been gamified. Things are stacked against the government's made so many bad decisions for so many years. And prices are so distorted, and the misallocation has gone on for so long that, yeah, the kids, what you're paying for school versus what I paid for school, what you're paying for mentorship versus what I paid for mentorship. Twitter was free. I mean, I stumbled into Fred Wilson for free. Good luck getting that
on the blog
today.
In the comments. Yeah. How are you going to do that today?
Fred's not even blogging anymore. So, I mean, like, that's a cost now that's out of the system. Like, it's you can't, you know, even if I pay it forward, like, do you believe that I have that good a relationship with Fred? Like, I don't want to prove to anybody, but like, you wouldn't even believe that stuff was going on. It was just a magical moment in time that I just loved, and no different than like the troubadour was for music in San Francisco for an era. And if you just happen to be there, I don't want to apologize. I don't want to brag. I just happen to be there. I don't see that happening. If you're looking for that to happen, it's not going to happen in the same place. So I'm not quite sure what's the next big thing, but it ain't going to be what just was. And it definitely won't be easy money. Although I can see why kids still want to play the YOLO game, because that's the playbook that Chamath and all these people, that the false prophets are using. You know, not again, I'm not to be smirching Chamath. I'm a very smart guy, and I think he probably means well. And as Phil Perlman says, I'm sure his kids love him. God bless. But at the same time, I think there's false profiting. Like,
so many people are always going to follow that. The thing that just worked, the thing that they saw that just happened. Yeah. And that's the other reality.
And I think the benefit of knowing the market and falling price and like spending 10,000 hours doing stock twits and seeing how people behave, that's my edge. You know, so I'm just going to work that edge now until I die. But I'm also going to be honest about that edge. It's not, I can't statistically prove it, but I can statistically live my life in that way and, you know, try and show people what I'm doing. And so that's been fun. Just the idea of like knowing in my gut that I have a statistical edge, but not really being able to tell you this is going to surefire way to get rich. You know, if you take any one of my big ideas, it's going to be wrong. But if you pick a basket of my big ideas, I think you're going to do pretty good. You know?
Well, here's the baskets of big ideas. I know I got to get you out of here. I got some notes. I want to summarize this real quick for the people watching.
Okay.
We talked about money, as in money and friends, the social opportunity, social leverage, how that even when you pass on something like Twitter, back to this basket thing, just Twitter yields stock twits, yields the cash tag, yields Robinhood, the opportunity is there. And this whole, your whole career arc, it's about like networks of people and how they stack together. The jobs and the opportunities came from the people. Fred Wilton in the blog comments, which is wild. On the intellectual side, we barely got to touch on it, but seeing the opportunity in YouTube, to the blog, to the writing, to the daily things that I've been reading for what feels like almost decades now.
Yeah.
How long that's been going on. And now you're back on YouTube again with all these shows.
Yeah. The biggest mistake was, again, I don't like seeing my face. So I don't love video, but I do love video, right? Meaning
it works.
The people that like me can put up with my bad video. And it's more about audio. So Big mistake was, I tell people, I spent way too long on Twitter. So I'm not the angry old guy who's mad at Twitter. I'm just the angry old guy at myself for knowing the nightclub was not cool, but lazily staying there because that's where I thought my network was. And that's, if I can teach people anything, it's that like the rug got pulled on me, right? Like I'm shadow banned just like every other person was. And I should have left like JC, like Josh Brown left long ago to build my YouTube audience. Now, I'm telling people on YouTube that our Beehive investment
right.
is much along the same lines. It's like, if you trust YouTube, you're an idiot. Like comics are fleeing YouTube because they're getting screwed.
Yeah.
So they're the man just like anybody else is a man. So I think what's old is new. You know, one of my biggest trends is email, right? Like if you have an email user, they have an Gmail account, they're going to see your email.
Yeah.
And that's a pretty powerful.
There's not an algorithm there in the inbox. Like it's coming. It's hitting.
Well, there could be, and there could be deliberate. Yeah. Nothing's perfect, but I know my readers will call me if there's an email problem. Like they'll figure out a way to reach me and go, something going on versus Twitter. No one's going to tell me, hey, I'm not seeing your tweets.
No, because you wouldn't even know. You wouldn't even know that you're not even seeing it.
So again, this goes to the era of business. Everybody wants to get rich overnight. There is no surefire way to get rich overnight. And Warren Buffett didn't start making real compounding until his 60s. So like do the math, you know, your 20s and 30s and 40s, you're saving, you're grinding, you're building your network. The real wealth comes in your 50s and beyond. I know it doesn't, everybody wants to be rich in their 30s and it will happen for some, but you also be careful what you wish for. But I wish everybody huge success. I think the tools are out there in the market to learn how to invest. So then the other thing that's my whole shtick is like, learn the language of the markets. Right? When I was growing up, it was like, learn Chinese, learn French, learn Hebrew, learn Yiddish. What a fucking misdirection that was. Aren't we
right.
all
learn
talking
money.
English?
Learn money.
Learn the language of fear and greed. Like
yeah.
get wrecked. You know, fuck up your first $10,000 account. You know, education has just continued to be the biggest nightmare.
Like you said before, go back and watch Back to School again. That's probably one of the best lessons for this
year. Who's going to pay the Teamsters?
Who's going to pay the Teamsters? Yeah, when he's doing with the econ teacher.
What's your widget? What's your profit margin? What's an A? Like it was so great because I was that guy. I was that guy in the back of the classroom just making fun of my teachers.
Right.
And here we are 50 years later. I'm like, the teachers are corrupt. The teachers are pro-Palestine, not pro-Palestine, pro-Hamas. You know what I'm saying? They're pro the terrorists. That's the terrorists. It's like that. It's like the horror movie where like the Friday the 13th, they're calling from inside the house.
That was
a frightening thing.
That was supposed to be bad.
That was supposed to be bad. They're in the house. So I really worry about that stuff. But luckily, my kids are kind of past college era. So I feel bad for parents going through all this stuff right now. It's brutal. But parents got to be parents.
Right.
You know?
We all got to be team human first. We all got to take care of each other. And I think that's one of the things that you're a bright light out there in the community. You're helping make people laugh and keeping people talking about this and helping keeping them honest about this. And that's a beautiful thing.
Yeah. Smaller networks, like we found each other through Benjamin, smaller networks matter.
Yeah.
You don't have tweeting, doesn't matter. It does matter. Like I've learned a lot about the Israel scenario and I've learned more about the UN. So I'm saying it's not like Twitter's useless. It's just not what it was. You have to use it in a different way.
In a different way. Yeah.
Yeah. But I think more important to have a tighter network, not a looser network. And I think kids in the last 10 years learned what a loose network is, and they're going to learn a lot about what a tight network is when trouble hits. So build that more of a tighter network and really be careful who you pick as your mentors. Because a good mentor can really change the direction of, you know, your life. Anyways, it's great to catch up.
You're an intentional investor, Howard. Great. Thanks so much for the time today. Talk to you later.
See you, everybody.
See ya.
See you, bub. Thanks.
Thanks for tuning in. Be sure to like, share, and subscribe wherever you're watching The Intentional Investor so more people can find our show. You can follow Matt directly at cultishcreative.com or at cultishcreative on Twitter. For more great content at the intersection of investing and life, check out EpsilonTheory.com or at EpsilonTheory on Twitter.